You don't have to have a PhD in abuse dynamics in order to begin advocating for women and children. So if you're listening to this podcast and a light goes off in your head and you're like, I need to begin this journey and I am not where I need to be, that is the exact same moment you can begin speaking up and standing up for women and children. What have I been silent on that I shouldn't be silent on? Where do I need to publicly repent even, or even privately repent as it relates to the way I've related to this issue and women, maybe even in my own life, maybe even in my own home? The journey begins with self-awareness and putting on a posture of advocacy and compassion and empathy.
Well, hey, friends, this podcast has been brought to you by infinitumlife.com. That's a place to go check out a spiritual practice that is centered on Jesus, is about living love out loud in public. And it features practicing three postures: the posture of surrender, the posture of generosity, and the posture of mission, or others-focused living. I believe that the practicing of our faith is where all the demonstration of the good news lies. It's not enough just to believe. It's not enough for you just to believe. We have to practice what it is that we believe. So Infinitum is created out of that place, out of a desire to help people practice their faith. Maybe you're brand new to faith in general. Maybe you're an explorer and wanting to discover. Maybe you're deconstructing from what you thought was a certain faith. And now you're like, ooh, I don't even know what I believe. Maybe you've just been really dormant for a long time. No matter what it is, Infinitum Life desires to help and to help you get curious, to help you live a life of wonder and discovery at the awesome ways God's love keeps beckoning us to the deep places. So if you want to go deeper and you want to go wider and you just want to experiment, there are all kinds of ways. If you're listening to this in December, there's an Advent guide and that has family-based practices and kid-based practices. If you want to go over to Infinitum Life podcast, there's lots of prayers there. If you go to the website, infinitumlife.com, there's like daily prayers, posture practices. There's ways to start getting involved. There's a thing called the 30-day challenge, which is 30 days. Why not in January? Why don't you make it your 30-day let's get in spiritual shape challenge? Grab a friend and start that. All of those things are free, by the way, and available to help reawaken the curiosity that would lead us to life. Creator sets free, Jesus. I hope it helps you. Infinitumlife.com.
Kyle, we're in the middle of a new season of our podcast that's called Everything We Can't Live With About Clergy Sexual Abuse. Mm-hmm. And so we've covered a whole bunch of different topics with different guests, and it's been, yeah, frustrating and liberating at the same time, which often those two things go together. One of the thing we really want to talk to you about, and one of the reasons I've invited you on here, is I've been, you know, just sort of long admiring your posture and your solidarity and allyship. And there are not very many men who are willing and or able, it would seem, to do this. And this is one of the things I'm finding hard to live with about clergy sexual abuse, is what I would call the silence and sins of omission, especially from men. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this, and there's a lot of things that go with this. James has a quote he's going to read about the perils of indifference, because I feel like that might be part of the problem. So he's going to kick us off with this quote. And then I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how you got to this place, how you decided to speak up and use your voice, and then maybe how other people could follow suit. That would be so great.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Thank you for having me as well.
And yeah, Kyle's an amazing contributor, and a couple of series back dropped bomb after bomb after bomb. And so really, really excited about having Kyle back. I could listen to you for a long time. So it's really exciting to see you and hear from you again, friend. This is from what's called The Perils of Indifferent Speech by Elie Wiesel, who is a Jew who wrote the book Night, which lots of people in Canada have to read as part of their kind of high school course. A very, very difficult, but a very important book to read. And so when he talks about indifference, he says this: in a way, to be indifferent to suffering is what makes the human being inhuman. Indifference, after all, is more dangerous than anger or hatred. Anger can at times be creative. One writes a great poem, a great symphony. One does something special for the sake of humanity because one is angry at the injustice that one witnesses. But indifference is never creative. Even a hatred at times may elicit a response. You fight it, you denounce it, you disarm it. Indifference elicits no response. Indifference is not a response. Indifference is not a beginning. It is an end. And therefore, indifference is always the friend of the enemy, for it benefits the aggressor, never his victim, whose pain is magnified when he or she feels forgotten. The prisoner, the political prisoner in his cell, the hungry children, the homeless refugee, not to respond to their plight, not to relieve their solitude by offering them a spark of hope, is to exile them from human memory. And in denying their humanity, we betray their own.
Yeah, that's an amazing quote.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty heavy. I mean, so what do you think?
I think that, and you, again, you have to forgive me. I'm recovering from a cold, so I'm a little bit out of it. But I think that it's touching on a lot of very important points. Though I would say that its presentation is a little bit more, I guess you could say, philosophical, but I think that it's absolutely theological as well. In that God has created us in his image. And part of that, the dynamic of what it means to be human, is the capacity to feel, to have emotions, to have reason, and all these other kinds of things. And there's a very real sense where, almost even a danger, where I would say that bitterness and hard-heartedness are on the other side of that coin in regards to the way in which it numbs our humanness. And so let me say it a different way. There's two sides of a coin. There is the numbness, the emotional numbness that can actually be caused by trauma, can be caused by abuse. And one of the horrific or devastating realities of abuse is the way in which it can numb our emotions, and in do that actually assault the image of God in people. The flip side of that is the willful rejection of the imago Dei, which is indifference, which is apathy, which is a refusal to walk in the image bearingness that we have, which means to walk in and off our affections, our emotions, love, care, all these other attributes that God himself reflects and we reflect as image bearers. And so I think what that quote is really getting at is the fact that what you're dealing with when you're dealing with, again, especially within, like, you know, church culture, but it's also abroad. But when you're dealing with people who are apathetic to the realities of abuse, and indifferent to the realities of the assault of the imago Dei in others, which is what abuse is, what you are dealing with is people who are willfully rejecting what makes them image bearers. What was rejecting what makes them human in many regards, and that. I would argue that abusers are doing that when they abuse, but the enablers of abuse who enable through indifference are doing the same thing. They're essentially saying, I'd rather ally with an abuser than walk in the realities of the imago Dei, which would make me empathetic towards their victims. And what's even more devastating, and you were just alluding to this as well, is the fact that, and even ironic, is that some of the most apathetic people when it comes to abuse are people within spiritual leadership. The people who hold positions where they would say we are leaders or we are shepherds of other people's souls. And so my job, my vocation in life is to shepherd and nurture and disciple and help in the process of sanctification of other people, yet be apathetic. It's it's really hard to grasp. But I think that's kind of like what you're getting at when you're saying this is how frustrating it is that, you know, how can it be that those who are supposed to be models under shepherds, models of Christ even, can be apathetic when Christ was literally the embodiment of empathy and the embodiment of love in ways that were just that even, you know, when we read the various stories of how Jesus cared for the marginalized, how he cared for the scandalous within that social society, you know, it's appalling. Just the love of Christ and the empathy of Christ. And yet his under shepherds, pastors, shepherds, those who are supposed to be a reflection of Christ to the body of Christ can be so anemic when it comes to the very qualities that Christ himself reflected as the Son of God incarnate. And so, yeah, so I think that that's really where the tension is that it's not just a matter of even men. In general, which is a whole, so there's two levels here. One, men in general, you know, the apathy, the indifference, the disconnectedness that many of them have when it comes to advocating for women specifically, but also advocating for children and advocating for other men for that matter. But then there's the other layer that's even deeper of men in ministry, where it's like if ever there we were to find men who would be empathetic and passionate and zealous to advocate and protect the vulnerable, especially the sisters of God, especially the ones who Jesus said to protect children, that how they could be apathetic and that how ministers could be apathetic is just a whole nother level where it's really hard to come to terms with, especially in light of who Christ is and what ministry is supposed to be. So that's, yeah. I know that's a very long reflection.
It was a weighty quote.
So. No, but that is exact. I think you've nailed, yeah. You know, sort of my like I find this so hard to live with. And also the other thing I've come across is a lot of private empathy, but a lack of public advocacy.
Oh yeah.
And so I guess one of my questions I have for you, Kyle, is like, how did you go from being brokenhearted privately to actual public advocacy? And why do you think people don't make that shift very easily?
That's a good question. And there's layers to that answer. So let me think for a second of how I want to layer it. So I think that there's a couple layers there as it relates to me, myself being a survivor of abuse, both church abuse. And I would, without getting deep into the weeds of it, I would say a level of childhood exploitation when it comes to sexual issues and stuff like that. But there's multi layers there of my own story and my own experiences where there was a weight of trauma that I had already carried. But there's already an empathy that I say is cultivated through experience and personal experience. But then I would also say that as someone who, so before I became a Christian, I was heavily involved within gang culture. And being on the streets, involved in gang culture, some of my best friends growing up were actually women, some who were prostitutes, others who were strippers, maybe some single mothers. And I had a relationship with them that was not an exploitative relationship, but was an intimate relationship, not necessarily romantic, but just in the sense of friendship, of hearing, sitting with them, hearing their stories of abuse and of trauma and all these things that ultimately culminated in them living lifestyles where they were trying to survive, but that's their pursuit of survival through the limited capacities that they had socially and economically led them to whether it be prostitution or stripping at a club or something of that nature. And so from early on, when I was a teenager and some of my closest friends being women who were abused, oppressed, marginalized, and within a context and then forced within certain situations and contexts, that really broadened my perspective going into things, and especially as it relates to I never held to the view reading the story of King David that it was some kind of mutual consent. You know, based upon even my own experiences within my own relationships, I read that and without being deeply informed about abuse and all those things at that time when I first read it, it always read to me as this woman had no choice, you know, in the matter. You know, and so I would say that those perspectives had always been governing my life in a sense based upon my own experiences, and especially as a Black man, as someone who lived in the, and lived and navigated the margins of society and those kinds of things. Now, when it comes to ministry, what I would say is I honestly, and I'm trying to think of the best way to say this, because I'm not trying to like, what is it? I'm not trying to throw shade, as we would say, but I don't know how else to say it. But to me, I don't understand, or I cannot conceive of vocational ministry or ministry in any sense that is not on the front lines of advocacy and protecting the most marginalized or socially oppressed people within society. And so to me, being a minister, being a man and being in ministry that is not advocating for women, is not intention and children, and is not intentionally researching and seeking understanding and clarity and all these kinds of things. To be a man who is not doing that is as outlandish to me as a devil preaching, where it's like it's so contrary to what it is, to literally what ministry is. And I think one of the problems is, I think it is theological. If I was to put my historical theologian hat on for a second, I would say that I think that a anemic conception of the gospel, which is hyper individualistic, that, you know, a gospel that suggests Jesus just died for me, and or that or even a slave master theology of Jesus died for your soul, but not for any kind of sense of social liberation. So a gospel that is very shallow, rather than a gospel that is cosmic in scope, which is Jesus died and Jesus lived and died for the cosmic reconciliation and the unification of all things that have been devastated by the curse. And the work of Christ is redeeming a people, making them a church filled with his spirit, the Holy Spirit of love and light. And as those people live out in the world, they are pressing against the kingdom of darkness with the kingdom of light as far as the curse is found. That's a cosmic scope of the gospel, which means then that the church and those who lead in the church, preachers, pastors, ministers, the very work of ministry is to disciple people into emanating as vibrant of a light as possible into the kingdom of darkness. And so if you're in ministry, and you are not pressing against the kingdom of darkness, and it doesn't get much darker than molestation, pedophilia, rape, assault, abuse, you know, and all these kinds of things, assaults on the very image of God. What are you doing there? That's literally the job description. And Jesus understood the assignment. You know, Jesus, the Son of God incarnate, comes and representing the last Adam, representing the new humanity, perfect humanity, glorified humanity. He lives a life where he demonstrates complete and total compassion, love, and empathy, especially for the oppressed and the marginalized, especially for the spiritually oppressed and marginalized. And yeah, so when it comes to
he doesn't hold back, right? I mean, he's not only empathetic in terms of his solidarity with. So he goes out of his way to be in the way and in connection with people who have been marginalized or oppressed or exploited. But then he also publicly calls out the exploiters and the religious and the teachers. And so I think those two dual, because the other thing that confuses me is that the people that I know who I've challenged, hey, where are you publicly? Why aren't you speaking up against these abusers? Why aren't you calling out this leader? Like, where are you? You're silent. I mean, you're all up in my texts saying, praying for you, like, way to go, proud of you. But there's not one hint of solidarity publicly with me. So thanks for the support. But like, you know, where are you? And it ranges sort of from this like weird sense of like, that's not the right thing to do. It's like divisive somehow or something like that. So like this kind of responsibility, like I think we've all been groomed in a way of trying to protect the church's reputation by not telling the truth. And then the other side is that the people that I press, like, where are you? Why aren't you speaking out? Their empathy is highly engaged, but in the direction of the perpetrator.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think a couple of things is happening there, where on the one hand, There's another thing. There's another thing that is completely contrary to the vocation of ministry, and that's kingdom building. That a someone who is in ministry is someone who's devoted their life to the building up, the protection, and the security of someone else's kingdom, someone else's work, Jesus's. And it's not a nation, it's not a country, it's not a four-walled building. The kingdom of God is bigger than all those things. And I think what often happens, and I know exactly what you're talking about. It's literally the story of my life, of you know, but the behind the scenes encouragements. But it's, and to some sense, I understand it even more. I understand it to an extent because I do talk about controversial things, especially when it comes to issues like race and stuff. And so there's people who silently want to say, "Yes, Kyle, we agree with you," but publicly they don't want the controversy or the scandal of so they want to be as distant from me as possible while at the same time supportive of it. Yeah, it's funny, but
right, like
yeah. But what I would say is that I think that a lot of times people in ministry can get kind of, and it has to do with platforms, and you know, and it's cool to have a platform in some sense. I mean, you speak and there's people who you know, will listen to some extent, and so I understand it, but the people who, once they, in some sense, have some kind of following, whether it be in a church, in a pulpit, or whether it be online, whatever that following is, they begin to value it and to find it precious and wanting to hold on to it, because in some sense, they're wanting to hold on to their own sense of self-sufficiency, self-success. You know, self-worth, all these other kinds of things. And so they want to hold on to that. And so when it becomes in conflict with ministry, then they choose their own self-glory, or the preservation of their own platform. And I'm phrasing it in a certain kind of way on purpose, because to me is so I phrase it as their own platform and then ministry, because it's a contradiction. The moment you choose self-preservation of whatever platform you have, doesn't matter what the reason is, whether it's income security, whatever, the moment you choose non-confrontation for the sake of preservation for your own whatever you have, you are no longer operating in ministry. You have sold that birthright.
I love that so much. So whenever you, I want to just break that down. Whenever you choose non-confrontation for the sake of self-preservation. So that phrase, I think that's a very powerful phrase. So first of all, choice. So this is one of the things that I think has been inside me sort of raging, and I've been trying to communicate why I'm so upset about this. But basically the idea that the sin of omission is something that Protestants don't talk much about. So we talk a lot about the sins of commission. So people will be like, but I didn't do it, but I'm not that person or whatever. And so they don't identify that the sin of not doing something is an actual sin. It's like the sin of omission that, so I love that idea of whenever you choose non-confrontation. So when it's a choice you're making. We all know this, right? Because it's going to cost you something, because there's going to be pushback, because you're going to be maligned, which is the cost of solidarity. But I love that the way that you phrase that as a choice. So you choose non-confrontation, and the reason you choose it is really, if you're super honest, which again is probably a problem, getting to the self-honesty of, wow, I'm doing this because I'm afraid of losing my own fill in the blank.
Yeah. Side note, I hope this is received in the spirit in which I say it, as the saying goes, but I do believe that the pastoral ministry is filled with a lot of men who have not done the work of developing a healthy self-conception of themselves. So they lack healthy self-awareness as well as emotional intelligence. And so I believe that there is no other, I can't think of any other field really where those things are so essential. To do the work faithfully, and yet often so absent, you know, and so I do think that there is a choice that's happening, but at the same time, I think that a lot of leaders lack a level of self-awareness to such a degree that they don't even realize that they are actually making a choice. And part of that is even with the way that we the way that a personal platform is conflated with God's kingdom as well, right? Where they are able, people are able to convince themselves that seeking their interests is seeking God's. And so they are so able to conflate those two things that they will convince themselves that their apathy is God ordained, yes. That their indifference is actually being moved by the Holy Spirit. And because they lack the self-awareness to realize that they are pursuing their own ambitions, not God's, and that there is a radical distinction between the two. And the moment you're pursuing self-preservation, or the security of whatever platform you are seeking, you have misaligned yourself with God's kingdom and with God's ambitions, because God's ambition is not a minister's success. God's ambition is the success of his mission, which he sent his only begotten son to live and die for. And so I do think that that's a big issue, is the lack of self-awareness and emotional intelligence that keeps people from even being able to see that. Mm-hmm. But coming back to the bigger theme that you're talking about, what I would say is that, yes, ministry. So Jesus, you know, himself says, don't think I came to bring peace. I came to bring a sword. You know, I'm going to cause separation. It's going to be inevitable. Now, you know, you have the Theobos who will take that and run with it. And then they start using their mouth as a weapon, and they start trying to declare war on anyone who disagrees with them. And they think, again, that they're doing the mission of God. They've convinced themselves, because of their own immaturity, that they are doing the ministry of God, when really they're just stroking their own ego. But that's what I would say is that that's not, when I talk about confrontation, I'm not necessarily meaning, I'm not talking about fighting anybody. I'm not talking about you got to go and yell on Twitter. What I am talking about is standing in opposition to darkness. Mm-hmm. What I am talking about is actively standing, not passively letting it walk by you, but to be a minister is to be a mediator. It is to mediate between the kingdom of light and the kingdom of darkness. And you do that primarily through caring for God's people.
That's the distinction there, Kyle, that I think is key. Mm-hmm. Is one is divisive because you're at the center. The other is a confrontation with darkness because someone else is at the center.
Yes, absolutely. And the thrust is, again, when everything evolves around, you get this also when it comes to like doctrinal disputes, right? Where there's something that my mom used to say to me all the time. My mom's is a lawyer. And one of the things that she used to always tell me growing up was there's a difference between arguing for the sake of winning an argument and arguing for the purpose of winning over a person. And how you engage somebody will determine your motive for why you are arguing. And I think that oftentimes, especially within the church, even when it comes to like theology or doctrinal points, there's a lot of arguing for the sake of winning an argument, very little engaging for the sake of winning over a person. Mm-hmm. And the same thing could be said even when it comes to issues like abuse advocacy and these other things, where the purpose of ministry is lost. Ministry becomes about how many people are in your church, how secure is your membership roster, how much you can depend.
Your income stream.
How much your income stream is secure. Right. That's exactly what I was about to say.
Yeah.
Those become the mission, as opposed to the mission being, we are as a church, we are part of God's kingdom, and we stand as a beacon of light in a world of darkness. And our mission is to press against darkness with our Holy Spirit wrought light. Mm-hmm. And pastors and ministers and leaders and everyone are supposed to be equipping and encouraging and ministering and counseling and all these things, helping us to be firmly established in our light as we press against the darkness. But more than that, they are supposed to be modeling it. They're supposed to be the examples of what that faithfully looks like, just as Jesus was the example of what that faithfully looked like. But if you do that, especially in a world of darkness, there is going to be cost. You are going to be divisive. The issue isn't about whether or not you're divisive. The issue is, what are you dividing? You know, are you dividing light from darkness? Are you dividing in such a way? Are you dividing in such a way where victims of abuse are being crushed and their abusers are being elevated? There's a division that's happening there. You're dividing out the people of God that God cares most about. You know, you're putting them under the table and you're putting those who abuse them on top. So there is still you're divisive. It's just a question of what are you dividing? Are you siding with darkness? Are you siding with light? And again, recognizing that indifference is a sign. That is a choice, because ministry in many ways is not a noun. It's a verb. It's an action. It's not something you just inherently are because you got a ordination paper. A minister or ministry is action. It's activity. If you're a minister, then you are actively caring for and advocating for the marginalized, the oppressed, and you're seeking to minister to people. And if you're in ministry, you're seeking to press against the kingdom of darkness with the kingdom of light. And so it's an action. And if you're not doing those things, you aren't that. And so I do not think that I would not classify people or postures as being ministry or a minister if that's not what they embody. It's something else. You may be a life coach. You may be a religious figure.
Performer.
Yeah, like you could famous, be. You may be a religious entertainer who's very good with, has very good oratory skills. You may be all these things, but you're not a minister unless you minister. And you don't have a ministry unless it's a ministry, you know. And I think that part of the problem is there is a very real dynamic where those who do ministers who are not really ministers are the ones in which, because of celebrity culture, because of all these things, they are the ones who we most people most look to as being representatives of the ministry. When they there is nothing within their lives and actions that would suggest that they are in any way or capacity leaders in ministry or leaders of a ministry. Yeah. And so I want to reclaim the language in some sense and say, no, when I say pastor, I mean something with that. And it's not just something that you can just self-proclaim. When I say minister and ministry, those terms mean something. And I'm not going to let those who exploit them be the ones who define what they mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's one of the reasons I'm not ordained. I don't like the idea of ordination. I feel like the community I'm part of gets to make that decision, not like another group of people that might not know the community that I'm now serving. As ever, so much going on there. I want to like think about what you said a little bit earlier when we asked, you know, what is it that got you involved here? What made you speak up? And again, the answer is always proximity. Mm-hmm. The answer is like, I know the stories. I know the people where these stories are coming from, where these truths are being shared from. And so what's really interesting to me and something I want to kind of push back on, and I too, like very early on, I'd been in ministry for like 3 months. When I was 21 and started hearing some of these awful things that were happening. And that shapes you, right? That does shape you. It does affect you. It does impact you.
It can.
In a number of ways. Okay, sorry. It should. If you're a minister, it will. If you're not, it might not. It should. And like, so I think one of the things that jumps out to me, one is that I realized early on that justice is hard to come by. And I think that lots of people who are privileged, for those of you listening, I am a white man with every privilege you can imagine. Generally, people who with all the privilege assume that the world is fair. Bad guys go to prison. Good guys don't go to prison. If someone does something bad, they'll go to jail. That's like how the world works, right? But the more you spend time with people that aren't as privileged as you, the more you realize that simply isn't the case. So now I have lots of friends of color who have informed me that my understanding of the justice system, I have friends who have been incarcerated, who have shared with me how like my So a friend of mine who's in jail, if he wasn't black and poor, he wouldn't be there. It's that simple, right? And so kind of learning those stories early and realizing that things aren't fair, that's what's always curious to me when I hear people unwilling to stand up. I just think, do you not know anyone? Like, tell me who you know that has been through this and yet you still feel this way. Like, I feel that proximity has so much to do with this. And if you can't name anyone, like you have 100,000 Twitter followers and yet no one, like.
Yeah, I think that you're really onto something. And I guess what I would say, as as respectfully as possible that much of what we are talking about, by and large, maybe this is just an assumption that I'm coming with, but we are largely talking about white evangelical men.
Yeah.
More
other men, I'd say, like other religions too. I was in an Anglican context. The Catholic one is very famous. The Baptist one, I mean, so, but white men, yes.
So, but even more than that, I mean, there are religions and there are cultural, there are socio-cultural dynamics in other spaces that are not necessarily white, but the men dominate in some kind of patriarchal context where you'll find the same apathy. But I do think that there is a degree of uniqueness when it comes to looking at the white church in America and probably in Western Europe as well, and their posture when it comes towards these things, and then looking at other communities. Like, for example, when I think about the Black church, for example, has always been on the front lines of activism and justice, and pastors have always been on the front line, you know, advocating, you know, for survivors of abuse, even whether it be by the hands of police or other, and looking at not just simply ministering to people's souls, but recognizing the comprehensive nature of the task of ministry, to the point where even pastors marching, and someone like Dr. King, for example, you know, who is a pastor and preacher, yet still on the front lines. And so I do think that there is a dynamic of, again, proximity, where when you're, there are certain marginalized communities and cultures where it's inescapable, the realities, some of which I talked about just a moment ago. Well, I think for the most part, and I, speaking as somebody who went to Southern Seminary, has 3 degrees from Southern Seminary, I can say this without with the utmost confidence, they don't know anyone. You know, when I went to seminary, I literally encountered people. I was literally the only Black person they've ever met in their life. And those were some interesting conversations. But literally, it's like I'm the only Black person they've ever seen. And they're going to come to seminary. They're going to go through these classes and they're going to learn about the Black church, which is that the Black church is inferior to their own, you know, X, Y, and Z. And then they're going to go back to their space where they've never seen another white person. And all the books that they read, everything that's assigned to them, are going to be ivory tower white male theologians. And so especially so that there is entire traditions
chamber. Yeah,
exactly. Where you live in the head, you live in the head. All you think about is the head. How well you live in your head determines your piety, right? Where it's like the more you know, the more godly you must be based upon the information you have. That's really largely how white evangelicalism deals with its ministers and leaders, is their godliness and their Christ-likeness is determined by their gifts, charisma, and intellect. And that's gone on for a long time. And then now it's kind of a surprise that it's like, well, why are these people so apathetic? Well, it's like your entire culture has been a factory that has been producing men who lack emotional intelligence, self-awareness, and are narcissistic. And this is what comes out of that.
Yeah, this is the fruit.
The Theo blow is what comes out of that reality. You know, and the apathetic, indifferent to abuse, enabling of abuser, all of that has been a factory production, you know, for decades. It's just now hitting the fan. And it's hitting the fan now because people just assume that because a minister was a minister, that they would care. And then everyone started voting for someone who was, you know, for president, who was the embodiment of everything that we're talking about. And it was like, wait, y'all don't care. So there is a reality where it's like, I do think that proximity does matter, but when you are talking about a very large and powerful tradition, faith expression, American evangelicalism, where by and large, the factory that has produced its leaders, it has been one where proximity is not required or expected. And when Christ's likeness has never been determined by washing anyone's feet, you know, or advocating for the marginalized or the oppressed in any capacity, but has really been just building, you know, just buddy groups. Who do you know? What do you know? You know, how gifted of a speaker are you? And how well do you rub shoulders with the politicians that are going to, you know, produce the various social, socio-political agendas that we have? So I do think that there is that element as well that's at play.
Yeah, I love that this is fruit that's been produced, not just a dilemma.
It's not a bug, like, it's a feature.
Right.
This is what was always going to happen, right?
But Kyle, I'm interested in, when did you know? When did you make a choice to use your voice for the, particularly the abuse against women?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I would say that there was never a moment when I made the choice, at least in my mind. It was always just the natural overflow of what I believed ministry to be. I can tell you the decisive moment, but it was, again, it was more of an overflow. But the decisive moment would be when I was a lay leader at a local church, same church that abused my family. But as I was a lay leader at this church, there was a time when my wife was just actually, she had her own nail business at the time, where she was actually, you know, doing her own little side hustle. People would come over, she would do their nails, you know, make a little bit of pocket change, I guess you could say. And one day we had someone come over, and this lady began sharing with us about her experiences with the relationship. And my wife was just utterly shocked with what she was hearing. And so she was like, hey, you know, I think that you should share these things with my husband. You know, he's a lay leader, you know, this, that, and the other. So she shared with me, and it was some situations that was really, really bad. Long story short, I spoke with the elders about it, and it was like, hey, this is a situation that we need to deal with in regards to this man and how he's been relating to this woman. And the elders responded to me saying, okay, well, what we need to do is we need to get him in a room together. And we need to hear her tell us in front of him, you know, what transpired. And I was, again, natural overflow. I wasn't thinking this is my moment of revolution. I was just like, no, like, we're not going to do that. That's not going to happen. And these are the reasons why. And they insisted that we do it. And I was like, it's not going to happen. And it didn't happen. I put my foot down. Long story short, yeah, it didn't happen. She was protected. Things came to terms. It was even worse than things were originally, as it almost always is. But she was protected. And it was, that was a decisive moment where I began getting treated differently, you know, at the church, as well as the fruit of that, more or less, was more and more women coming to me in the church of, hey, Kyle is a safe person. I want to share that my story. And so it was a natural overflow of that, where we would have women who would join our group who were survivors of all kinds of horrific things. And, you know, my wife and I began, you know, caring for them. And that was where my trauma-informed soul care ministry, I guess you could say, was birthed. It came out of providing trauma-informed care for women survivors of abuse. And so, and then things just kind of advanced in that. And it was actually largely white women. And then over time, it became more focusing more on the minorities and X, Y, and Z. But yeah, so that was more of a natural overflow. There wasn't a moment of like, I'm going to take this on. It was just me doing ministry, just living life with people feeling comfortable enough to share within our home. And then my wife and I both, because I was a lay leader, my wife kind of co-led this community group that I led. And we just kind of like, the natural overflow is that I'm, you know, going to care. And the natural overflow of ministry is that there's no way in hell that I'm going to let this woman sit in a room with someone who's doing the things that she said and make her face him in that space. Like, this is not happening. I wasn't even necessarily abuse informed at that point. It was just simply like, to me, it was just kind of like, duh.
Yeah.
Vaguest bit of empathy is enough.
But that's also part of your formation at seeing people marginalized and excluded and then used.
Yeah, yeah. That's fair. Yeah.
You could intuitively sense what's going on here. If you have any advice or direction for men who might be listening to this, please, I hope, where they could, one, be safe for people, and two, become advocates or allies. What are ways in which men can make deliberate choices to move towards true authentic ministry?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first thing I would say is that you're not safe just because you think you are.
Yep.
You don't get to determine whether or not you're safe. The people, women, and I'll throw in even the children, determine whether or not you are safe based upon how they relate to you. And so, and yeah, so that to me, that's the first thing that I would say. And if you don't know any women who are survivors of abuse, it's because you're not safe. It's not because they don't exist in your sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. It's because based upon the statistics, it is virtually impossible for a man to navigate this world and not come into close proximity in relationship with women who are survivors of some form of abuse.
Right. It's
and also
just for those listening.
So if you know two women, you might be able to like,
if you know three women, one of them has been abused. Yeah. So,
Yeah. So I would say that at the outset is that is this isn't an issue of whether or not it's an issue of the fact of if you're not aware, it's not because you haven't had a need to, it's because you have demonstrated probably to some of the women in your life that you should not be approached with this and therefore they'd haven't approached you with it. Now, with that being said, that does not mean that all hope is lost and that you can never become someone who is safe. What it does mean is that before you can be at the very beginning of that journey, it requires an acknowledgement of where you genuinely are within that journey. And so you have to come to terms with where you are. And if where you are is that you haven't even begun, then the answer to that is not to just continue taking a nap on this issue, but it's to get up and actually begin the process or begin the journey of exploration, not only of yourself and growing in self-awareness and growing with and cultivating sensitivity and empathy and focusing on your own heart of cultivating a heart that beats after the things that God's heart beats after, such as the vulnerable. So first it begins with you. It doesn't begin with picking up a book. It doesn't begin with, though that's important. It doesn't begin with this podcast isn't even going to be like anything essential if you have not done the work of acknowledgement, which comes by way of self-assessment and self and cultivating self-awareness. So once you begin that process and you come to the terms with the fact of this is something that I haven't invested in. This is something that I believe that I need to be committed to, especially if you're in ministry, that if I'm going to continue claiming to be a minister of Christ, then I need to be someone who embodies these realities. Then you begin a journey towards learning, educating yourself about the statistics, about the dynamics and all those kinds of things. And so, and you should do that. Now, side note with that, what I would say is, you don't have to be you don't have to have a PhD in abuse dynamics in order to begin advocating for women and children. Yeah. It doesn't begin there.
People in the back. The
moment you begin to, the moment you have self-awareness. So if you're listening to this podcast and a light goes off in your head and you're like, I need to begin this journey and I am not where I need to be. That is the exact same moment you can begin speaking up and standing up for women and children. That does not, you do not have to learn anything more in order to begin loving women and children, especially those who have been wounded. And so what I would say is that begins at the same time, the self-awareness, as you begin speaking up, as you begin acknowledging, as you begin, you know, engaging, then yes, grow in your knowledge, you know, look for books, look for resources, listen to women, women who thankfully the Lord has given us many sisters who are speaking about these things, raising awareness about these things, you know, listen to their podcasts, watch their videos, read their books, you know, and do those things, allow women to have a voice and to be censored in your life and in your knowledge in regards to coming to terms with, you know, all these realities. But again, that does not come, that is a process that happens over time. Becoming a minister of Christ is something that happens immediately. It's something that you can do as soon as you get off this podcast is you can begin thinking through, what have I been silent on that I shouldn't be silent on? Where do I need to publicly repent even, or even privately repent as it relates to the way I've related to this issue and women, maybe even in my own life, maybe even in my own home? And, you know, and so I don't know if that answers your question the way you feel free to, if you want any other angle, but what I would emphasize is the journey begins with self-awareness and putting on a posture of advocacy and compassion and empathy. That's the beginning. That's the starting line. And then begins the journey of exploring different resources and to grow in greater measures of awareness in regards to how you can most faithfully and effectively continue that journey.
Yeah, I love that so much. I think even just that itself is so helpful. I can think of, you know, a dozen people I know that were declared unsafe by survivors to go to speak to about their own abuse within systems where they were abused. And that itself should be a light. It should be like a red flag in your own heart to say, what about my behavior? What about my communication? What about my posture? What about my track record made me unsafe? And then start there. Like I love that so much. The last question, and that's it. We're just going to call it after that because there's so much to. I actually feel like we might just have a recovery podcast on this podcast to talk through some of the things you've said. Thank you so much, Kyle. But what I've talked to men who are afraid to advocate, I feel like in the conversation I had with them, because they've over-identified themselves with male leaders, if that makes any sense. So they feel already culpable because they're a male leader. And so I'm like, so I would ask them things like, well, did you abuse anybody lately? Like, have you abused somebody? Is there something we should know about? Like, tell me more. Like, why are you so they're afraid because they're male leaders. They almost feel apologetic for being male leaders. So it's like, do you have any advice for men like that? Or, you know,
that's an interesting dynamic. And I can empathize with it. So again, as a soul care provider, trauma-informed soul care provider, I regularly talk with women who have experienced profound measures of abuse at the hands of men. And for some mysterious reason that I'm grateful for God for, they feel that they can open up to me and that they can, you know, they can speak to me and those kinds of things, you know. But even with that being said, I recognize 100% fully that I in many cases can represent or embody their trigger, the thing that has hurt them. And my posture in response of that is not being offended or to like turtle up, you know, like put myself in my shell. My posture in response to that is gentleness, kindness, and a desire to reassure them of my own love and my love towards them. And I'm willing to take my time. I'm willing to be patient. You know, I'm willing to, one of the things I often do, especially when it comes to counseling, is that if I'm counseling in any kind of abuse situation, whoever I'm counseling has all the power. They have the keys of that entire, soul care relational dynamic. They decide what we're talking about. When do we talk about all those kinds of things? And so I'm constantly posturing myself in a way that reassures them that they have control, that they have power, that I'm here to serve them, and that I love them. I don't shell up. Mm-hmm. And so what I would say to men who feel that way would be, again, honestly, speaking back to the dynamic of self-awareness, mm-hmm. which is if your response is to shell up rather than to pursue gentleness, kindness, love, and understanding, and those, and patience, and all those, the fruits of the spirit, 1 Corinthians 13, love, then you have to ask yourself why. Because the only thing that I can conclude, if your response is to shell up rather than to be outward, is self-preservation. Mm-hmm. And so your default to shell up rather than to engage is actually the evidence that testifies against you, mm-hmm. that you're not safe.
Right.
Because a safe person is not going to be self-preserving, mm-hmm. when they're engaging with survivors. They're going to be self-giving. Mm-hmm. And so, and so what I would say to you is that I don't say that to shame you in the sense of being like, oh, look at you, you're being, but what I am saying is that that's that dynamic itself speaks to your need for self-awareness, because what you're not being aware of is that there is something within you that is causing you to default to the very action that testifies to your unsafeness. Yeah. And so again, You have to work and towards
that perpetuates the violence, really.
Exactly.
The lack of 100% or solidarity or, you know, is a perpetuation of the violence. And I talk to victim after victim after victim who says the silence is actually more harmful to them and more painful to them than the actual abuse. Oftentimes the
100%,
lack of protection, the lack of solidarity, the lack of calling out the perpetrator is its own violence. And I think sometimes people don't realize that, like, this, you are doing something terrible by not doing anything at all.
Yeah. And you don't have to be, you don't have to master speaking before you speak. If you recognize that you should not shut up, that you should speak because, love, the love demands it, then do it. Yes, it may be clumsy. Yes, it may, you may, you know, even stumble at times. But there's a multitude of grace for that, especially among survivors, and the fact that you're trying as opposed to not even doing anything at all. Right. Most survivors rather you try to stumble through empathy than just be apathetic.
Yes.
You know, because the struggling to be empathetic is a demonstration of pursuit, of activity, of engaging, of trying.
It's minutes.
You know, and so I think one of the best things that a lot of men could just simply do is just simply speak, just simply acknowledge the realities and allow, you know, over time for the convictions to grow, for the empathy to grow and everything else. But the only reason in my mind that someone does not speak or will not speak is self-preservation. Mm. And self-preservation has no place in ministry because there is nothing in the world that will lead you to compromising faithfulness in ministry than self-preservation. It is the ministry killer.
Yeah.
Self-preservation will always be a ministry killer because ministry is the antithesis of self-preservation.
Yeah, it's the opposite of Jesus.
Exactly.
It is what it looks like to lay down your life. So it's the opposite.
Exactly. It's self, ministry is self-denial. Ministry is a denying of self for the sake of others. Mm-hmm. Power is not for you to build your own kingdom. Mm-hmm. Power through the economy of Christ is a tool that is given to you to empower others.
Yes.
Your power is a mechanism or a tool to serve, to empower others who lack power. And so it's constantly to be given away, not held or preserved. And so, yeah, so the whole self-preservation thing is I can't speak because of this person, of this, just that you are sabotaging your own ministry and your own credibility because that is a posture of self-preservation. It's not a posture of Christ-like ministry.
Well, I love it, Kyle. Again, as usual, you're so helpful. And not only giving us truth that we can really take to heart, and I'm praying that as people listen to this, that they'll begin that self-reflection journey and it'll lead them to light and truth and freedom and justice, and it'll be used to free others. But also, I feel like your example in this regard gives a power. You've demonstrated, not just proclaimed, what this looks like. So I just want to thank you for using your power to help empower others and to being someone who is in solidarity with and willing to pay the price of that. Mm-hmm. And I want to let you know publicly that that is powerful. It is powerful. It matters. And I've seen it matter in real people as I've talked to them, but also to me, it's mattered a lot. It's meant a lot.
That means so much. Thank you so much for those kind and encouraging words. It truly means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah. So keep it up. Keep it up. And we'll just keep going together. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Kyle.
Thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it.